1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Church.
I'm Jim Russ. We're actually sort of in the virtual hallway just outside the classroom
I barely made it into the to the appropriate location here for the show.
Right.
But it's been, kind of interesting week, but it's been going on. The police have arrested the guy that was behind the big denial of service attack, DDoS attack against Spam House. They arrested him, and that made the news a while ago. Google has hired a famous jailbreaker, iPhone jailbreaker. He worked there at Apple for a while, and then they let him go after kind of a murky description, and then he's gone. Living Social was hacked. Like 50 million accounts were revealed. That's not really that good.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of news there. Today we're going to feature the man. He's a programmer who likes open source programming. He's best known for starting the Genome Project, which is an interface for Linux. Miguel de Icaza. He's a Mexican, and he's a big open source guy. And of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Terribly huge.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yeah. We got an email from Lynn in Ohio. Dear Doc and Jim, is antivirus for my smartphone required? I have an Android and my husband has an iPhone. Sometimes we go to sites that could be considered dangerous.
Uh-oh.
And there's a little smiley face there. Lynn, what kind of sites are you looking at on your smartphone? That little smiley face, indicates...
It's in italics, which means it's extra smiley.
And so I really don't know whether you mean your husband goes to those smiley face websites or you do, but either one could be bad. She goes on to say, we have antivirus on our desktop, but do not have any protection on our cell phone. I love to listen to the show streamed live over the internet. Lynn in Ohio. Well, we got a live listener. They're not a podcast listener. Well, the good news is the iPhone is really not too vulnerable to viruses yet. The hackers haven't gotten into it yet. The iPhone is a little operating system is a little bit harder to hack, so they've just decided to go after the easier targets, which of course would be the Android. So the Android actually is vulnerable. And if you're going to those smiley face websites, then I think you need to get an antivirus, certainly for the Android. They have a free version, AVG Antivirus, free. It's the free version. That's also a very good desktop, free desktop antivirus. So you can actually download that application, install it on your Android. Go to the store, download AVG Antivirus, free. Now, if you want, you can... as always, it's freemium. You get the free version, but if you upgrade a little bit, they have additional features like, protecting your cell phone in the event it's stolen. That you could lock it, you could wipe it, that sort of thing. So, but AVG Antivirus free is good. And there are a lot of other ones out there that you can buy for like $9 or $10, but I'd recommend the free one. So that's a very good question, Lynn. And stay away from those smiley face websites.
I think they should have used more of the winky face than the smiley face.
Yeah,
if you know what I'm
thinking.
Saying.
I don't know what Lynn's up to up there in Ohio. We got an email from Margaret. Dear Doc Schertz, it would be so great if you can help me and others navigate Google Groups. I'm looking for work as a business analyst in the D.C. Metro, and I did just a general search and landed on this attachment. It was exactly what I'm looking for, although the job announcement's almost closed. I want to join this group, but can't determine what group it is. If you can decipher and educate me on how to use Google Groups, I'd be most helpful. All the best, Margaret. Well, I took a look at the attachment. It actually was an attachment of one posting to a Google group that was talking about an open job for business analysts. So you can go to Google Groups. Just go to groups.google.com. That takes you to the main Google Groups site. Now, what's nice is once you get on the Google Groups homepage, you can do a search. And so you're interested in business analysts, just do a search on business analysts. And I, for instance, found that there was a business analyst group that might be worthwhile joining, for instance. Now, the particular page that you came up with was one listing. Now, if you look at the title of that listing, just above it in small print is the name of the group. Now, in your case, the name of this group was Dot Less. And it was basically, you know, they're saying instead of .net, it's .less. It's kind of a game on not using .net. Mm-hmm. So you click on, and that's actually a link. So you simply click on .less, and that takes you to the main page for that group. And then there's a blue button that says join the group. So you could join the group. So that's really all there is to it. Google Groups are quite nice. Now, when you want to join a Google group, you're going to have to, of course, log into Google Groups. And you just use your Gmail account. Just use your username and password. Log into Google Groups, and then you can join any group you want. Great question. And Google Groups are really trying to push that as they go out with Google Plus, and Google's trying to really move into the social networking arena. We got an email from Lauren. Dr. Schertz, I'm grateful that you answered my question on 420. That would be last week. But what you told me actually didn't work.
Uh-oh.
This was where she had an extra blank page after posting in some graphics,
yeah.
Remember?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, surrounding the graphics, you do have a formatting character, and sometimes you can make that smaller and smaller point. That particular trick works if the graphic fills the whole page and that formatting mark is then kicked to the next page. So actually, Margaret sent me her document, which had this mysterious blank page in it. And I couldn't see any formatting. I think there was some type of corruption that had been put in the file at the time she inserted the document. So what I did, I did a paragraph return on the previous page to give sort of a blank paragraph. I did a paragraph return on the following page to give a blank paragraph. And then I highlighted the bottom of the previous page and the top, and I dragged that highlight all the way down to the top of the next page, and I hit delete.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever was in there that I couldn't see because it was probably some kind of corruption or formatting that's not going to display, it just deleted it. So as soon as I did it, bingo, the page was fixed. I sent actually, because she was a little bit desperate, I sent her back an email and told her how to do it. And she wrote back to me, and she wrote me an email. She says, Dr. Schertz, you're just wonderful. So it was another successful version, but it took two attempts to get the right answer for Lauren. We got an email from Led by Brain. Dear Dr. Schertz, last Saturday I bought an iMac for use at home. However, we use Microsoft Office at work, and sometimes I need to work in the evenings on Word or Excel. I was looking for an inexpensive way to access my Microsoft documents on my iMac. It seems like SkyDrive is my answer. It is appearing that I would have access to Word in the cloud using SkyDrive. Word that works on my iMac, that would be really good. And now, you know, but now I'm trying to figure out how I can import and open docs that I've sent to myself. So I've sent the docs to myself. How can I open them in SkyDrive, and how can I make this thing work? Hope you might help me with this. Your show is so helpful. And another smiley face. All the best. Led by Brain.
We are leading the league in smiley faces today.
We are certainly looking good on smiley faces today. But this is a different kind of smiley face.
It means
something completely different than what Lynn's smiley face was.
Totally.
Yeah.
Let's hope so.
Well, this is the thing. You have an iMac. You could install a version of OpenOffice, which is a which is a which is free, of course, and it's open software. And so you could install that, and that will actually allow you to edit documents quite well, but it does not have all the features of Microsoft Word. Now, what we do at Stratford, we give many of our employees VPN access, and they log into their desktop at work. So they can see their desktop, and so they basically log into the desktop at work, and it's a thin client connection, and they can use then their Microsoft Office software that's installed on the computer at work, and so they can work on all their documents quite easily. Now, we have at Stratford, we use SharePoint, which is a where to share documents. So if you've got a group editing it, we can all share on it. I suspect that your company would have SharePoint, but then you have to have the rights to log into the SharePoint server from home and the rights to log into your desktop from home in order for this to work. Now, Microsoft does have SkyDrive, which is actually a cloud-based drive, just like Google Drive, and they'll give you 7 gigabytes of free storage. Now, what they're hoping is that you'll need more than 7 gigs of storage, and then you'll pay extra for additional storage. So, in fact, you could do SkyDrive, and you could store your document there. And if you want to use SkyDrive, when you install SkyDrive, you basically simply set up a subdirectory on your computer. You drag the document into that subdirectory, and it automatically synchronizes with SkyDrive. That's how it gets there, through synchronization. So you'll synchronize SkyDrive with the folder on your machine. You could have a SkyDrive, you could have another synchronization folder on your computer at work if they allow you to have that. And then once you copy a document into that sync folder, it'll automatically synchronize with SkyDrive. It's just like the iCloud with the iPhone. Now, SkyDrive does not give you Microsoft Office, though. It's just storage. Now, what Microsoft is doing in order to compete with Google Docs, they've created Microsoft Office 365, and it's basically a thin client, cloud-based version of Office, which you can get on a monthly subscription fee, and that's what you'd have to have. Now, if you just want to do it for like 30 days, you can get a trial version that will give you access for 30 days. If you want to get MS Office 365, the cloud-based MS Office, you'll need a subscription. It's about $60 a year. Or if you just want to do it monthly, it's $6 a month. And you just use it for as long as you want. You can test it out with the 30-day free deal. So that would be the way I would do it. Now, Microsoft put this MS Office 365 because they're trying to compete with Google Docs, because it's clear that the trend is going more and more toward these cloud-based applications. I mean, at Stratford, we share all of our documents between campus deans, campus director using Google Docs. And actually, it's quite nice. You can actually see people updating the documents easily. So that actually works fairly well. So I think those are all of your options that you'd have. And I think it's just useful for your own sort of future employment to get used to using SkyDrive. I'd get used to SkyDrive. I'd do the synchronization. I'd log on to the I would get an account for MS Office 365, a free trial version, see how you like it, and maybe you could get your employer to spring for that $60 a year or $6 a month. We got an email from Patricia. Dear Doc and Jim, I have a Bank of America banking app on my iPhone. Is it safe to use this application in an unsecured Wi-Fi hotspot like McDonald's or Starbucks? Thanks, Patricia. That's a very good question.
That's a very good question.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you want to know whether your app is using HTTPS or not. In other words, is it an encrypted data stream? Now, you would think that banks would only use encrypted connections, but you're never really sure. You can't count on them doing it the correct way. Now, I did check on the Bank of America application, and this application delivers mobile banking that's fully encrypted, and they have added security. They have something called a site key on it, as well as a safe pass. Now, the site key is displayed only when the Bank of America recognizes the device you're signing in from. So you go in, they do a challenge question, and then you can establish that device. And they put a cookie there so that they recognize that device as a legitimate device. Then what they do, they download what's called the site key, and you know, and these are really different pictures, the site key. And this gives you some assurance that you're logged on to a real Bank of America website. You know, sometimes these websites don't really give you that, and then you won't get the site key. And the other thing that the Bank of America application has, they have what they call SafePass. This is one additional level of security. And what that does, when you want to log on, it sends you by text message a one-time log-on key, which then you can log on. So this is a double measure. So actually, Bank of America has done quite a good job of security. Now, that being said, even though I use Bank of America app, I still do no banking at hotspots. I just don't like doing it.
Yeah, no.
I tend not to do banking when I'm traveling overseas. I just try not to use any of these sites that are highly sensitive any place except at home and locally.
Sure.
But that was a great question. We got an email from but one thing I will do, like if I'm at McDonald's and I've got to check my banking app, I'll turn off Wi-Fi, and then I'll go to the banking app using the cellular connection.
Sure.
And that's okay.
That's more secure that way.
It's much more secure. So I will use my banking over the cellular connection, just simply turning off Wi-Fi if I'm at McDonald's or Starbucks. We got an email from Alice. Dear Tech Talk, I periodically clean my hard drive using CC Cleaner. After running the program, my bank does not recognize me, and I have to go through, it's like apparently a bank logon does not recognize me, and I have to go through this whole authentication process. They ask you a challenge question. Mm-hmm. Who was your dog? Who's your grandmother? Whatever challenge questions they have. Where did you grow up? How can I avoid? What kind of sites give me smiley faces? Whatever questions they want to, are they going to be asking you? Then how can I avoid this? Thanks, Alice. Well, many banks do have a good level of security, and they actually have two stages of verification. And on a computer, once it's recognized, what I just went through, they'll send a cookie down to your site, and that cookie is going to sit there. And when you log back on, it recognizes this as a computer that they've seen before, and they trust that computer, and they don't have that extra level of authentication. Now, when you're running CC Cleaner, one of the processes, it actually deletes all the cookies.
Mm-hmm.
So when you log back on, there's no cookie. The bank says, we've never seen this guy before. And you got to go through this whole rigmarole. So what you can do before you run CC Cleaner, it gives you a chance to specify exceptions. So just search your list of cookies for the Bank of America cookies and put them in the exception listing, and it will not delete the cookies next time you run it. It's relatively easy to do. Now, it may be kind of tricky to figure out what the cookie looks like. So what you could do would be to say, delete the cookies one time, go in and log into your Bank of America account, and then go in and look at the cookies, and there should only be one cookie there. It's the one you just created. And then that would be the cookie, and you can simply make that your exception. We got an email from June in Reston. Dear Tech Talk, I'm installing a surveillance camera in my basement, and I want the camera to send emails to my Gmail account. I have to provide the SMTP server username and password. What is all this? And I really don't know what I'm doing here. Love the show. June.
What's going on in her basement? That's my question.
That's right. Exactly. What are you doing in your basement that you need to send out pictures? You know, what is going on with the mailbag today? What is going on? I don't know. We've got some wild.
Everybody's a little frisky today.
They really are. Well, this is the deal. In order to send email through an email service, you have to use the Post Office Protocol, POP. Okay, incoming mail is forwarded through what they call the POP server. That's incoming email. And outgoing email is forwarded through the SMTP server. Now, that SMTP stands for Simple Mail Transfer Protocol. So you need the name of the SMTP server if you're going to do outgoing mail. And if authentication is using, you're going to need username and password. Now, the reason that they do normally require authentication for outgoing mail is they don't want spammers to use that outgoing mail server to send out a lot of spam. So they want to have the outgoing mail function password protected. Now, it turns out Gmail is just web-based email. There is no POP service, just with that web interface. But what Gmail has done, which is really nice, They allow you to implement a POP email or an IMAP email format. So what you want to do, you sign in the Gmail, and in the upper right-hand corner, there's this little gear-like looking thing. Click on that gear thing, mm-hmm. and there's a drop-down menu. Go down to Settings, click on Settings, and you'll see an array of menus across the top once you get into the Settings page, and you'll see something called Forwarding and POP/IMAP. So you click on that, and there's a section there for POP, and you just say Enable POP Server. And once you enable the POP server, Gmail then gives you an incoming POP server, an outgoing SMTP server, and then you could actually set an email client up on your computer just like a regular POP account. Now, so once you've configured it, now you've got an SMTP server. You want to save this, and then you want to go in. Now, the address of the SMTP server that you've just set up, it's really not too complicated, smtp.gmail.com. And that server op, and then you'll also, I think you also had to specify the port here,
mm-hmm.
June. You didn't tell me that, but I know you have to specify the port. And so as you click and using SSL, secure socket layer, which I would recommend, which would be encrypted, you're going to want to put in port 465.
Ah.
If you want to use another type of encryption called transport layer security, which is a higher level encryption that Gmail offers, that's called TLS, it would be port 587. Now, if you're having trouble getting any of those ports working, you might try port 25 with SSL. That's kind of the standard port, and you may have firewall issues with these other ports. So that's really what you've got. Now, when you put in the username and password, use your username for Gmail, but put in your full Gmail account username at gmail.com. Make certain you put the at gmail.com and then use your Gmail password. And that should be the only configuration that you need to use the outgoing mail server for Gmail. That was a good question. A
yes.
lot of people are confused by this because they just don't understand all this server business.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. There's all the entire mailbag taken care of in great order.
Now, we have a little bit of extra time. I have a question. My iPhone is running really slowly, and I have a funny feeling. I don't have a whole lot of storage space left on this thing. I have about 500 photos on here.
Mm-hmm.
Should I delete some of the photos? Would you think that would make it?
Yeah, I would. That's what I would do. I mean, if you do run out of RAM, it's going to slow down.
I'm looking here for the how much space I have.
Because you've got the 16 gigabyte. You probably have the 8 gigabyte. What? How much?
It's a capacity 6.3 gigabytes. Available 181 megabytes.
Oh yeah, you are you're down in the megabyte range.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you just are about out of memory.
So I got to get rid of some stuff.
Yeah, I'd get rid of some. Now you can just transfer it to a desktop.
Just drag the pictures out, save them on a thumb drive or something like that.
Yeah,
that's
because
not a bad idea.
If you hook your iPhone up to your laptop or to a computer, it's going to mm-hmm. look like an external drive, and you can just copy all of the pictures. I'll copy all the pictures there, and that would be an easy way to do it.
That's not a bad idea. I was kind of like weeding some of the pictures out the other day, and I just
now see if you would now if you would use the iCloud and you would synchronize the pictures, they would automatically transfer to your.
I got to do that
to your desktop.
That's really
and then,
what I need
and then
to
you
do.
Could you, then what you do is you anything in photo stream. So you take a picture. It doesn't go initially into PhotoStream. You then from the iPhone you move it to PhotoStream, and it mm-hmm. automatically synchronizes through the iCloud. Then you go to any computer that you've got that iCloud synchronized account on, and there will be a PhotoStream folder there. If you want to keep that photo, then move it to another subdirectory. Because if you delete it on your iPhone, you delete it from PhotoStream, then it's gone from your. It's just a synchronization folder.
Gotcha.
So that would be the easiest way to do it, and then you can go through your desktop or your laptop and at will move the pictures out of the PhotoStream folder to the other folder,
mm-hmm.
and then you can just delete what's in PhotoStream.
Makes sense.
So if you save it in PhotoStream, you'll actually save each picture twice. It goes into the picture folder, then the PhotoStream folder. So it shows up twice on your iPhone.
Now, I noticed under the photo section, I got to bring this back here, the phone, you can set up albums. Mm-hmm. But what happens when you set up an album is the picture remains in the main portion of the camera directory. Mm-hmm. So you're actually saving that picture twice on the phone? Is that what
See,
you're doing?
I don't know whether there's a pointer in there or not.
Uh-huh.
Now, if they've written the software well, there would just be a pointer. Like I set up three or four albums that I synchronized.
Mm-hmm.
So you could set up an album for different, like if you go on a different trip, a different vacation, so you could set up an album, you could synchronize it. Then you could share that album with other people with Gmail accounts. And so as soon as you take a picture and put it in that album, it shows up on everybody else's cell phone. I mean, have you been on a trip and people say, yeah, give me that picture. So what I did, I created an album for the trip, and I made it and I shared it just like PhotoStream.
That's a neat idea.
Because what Google does, you just don't have to share PhotoStream. You can create any folder and you can share it. So then I created a separate folder, and then I would take a picture and I would copy to that folder, which I shared with other people that were mm-hmm. on the same trip. And as soon as I shared it with them, it said, somebody wants to share a folder. Do you accept? And they'd say yes. And so as soon as I copy the picture to that folder, it automatically shows up on their iPhone.
That's a pretty neat idea.
But then if I delete it from my folder, it's deleted from there because it's synchronized. So if they want to keep those pictures, they've got to move them to another folder.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a great way to share stuff. And the iCloud is really convenient once you get used to it.
This is great information, and I got to do something because clearly, I mean, I've become the guy who hated all things Apple is now just completely stuck.
See, next with this iPhone. I think you got a very low memory iPhone.
Probably
got,
so.
I think you got the.
Well,
I'm guessing you got the cheapest.
I'm sure I did because after trade-ins and discounts because uh-huh. it was time for an upgrade, I think I paid $38 for this.
$38. So I'm thinking you either got 8 gigs or 16 gigs.
Yeah, probably 8, I would think.
Well, okay.
Thank you for your information, Doc. Thank you for all of your emails, and we need more emails for next
That's
week, so
right. We
that?
Love your emails. Send us your emails to techtalk@stratford.edu and make certain to go to techtalkonline.com, sign up for the podcast, go to Apple iTunes and sign up for the podcast. We love you to listen over the airways, and always go to stratford.edu and check on their websites. And finally, we're checking the Facebook page. So go to facebook.com/techtalkonline and leave your comments.
And thank you for listening to Tech Talk Radio every Saturday morning at 9 on Federal News Radio, heard on 1500 AM in Washington, 820 in Frederick, and around Northern Virginia on 107.7 FM HD2. More of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Today we're going to feature Miguel de Icaza. Miguel de Acasa is a Mexican open-source software programmer. He is best known for starting the genome in Mono projects. The Mono project was making essentially a .NET developer suite. Miguel de Acasa was born in Mexico City in 1972. He studied at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de Mexico. What do you think?
I don't know. Autónoma
de Mexico, but never got a degree. You know, he's another disappointment to
his parents.
To a proud mother and father. He started writing open source code and, you know, burning the midnight hours, sitting around at all moments writing and never doing homework. He started writing his open source code in 1972. That's when he was around 20, probably when he was a junior. And all that open source code writing just got in the way, and he never graduated. He wrote the first application that he wrote, he's quite well known for, is the Midnight Commander. The Midnight Commander, it's a file manager written for Linux, a text mode file manager written for Linux. So you could, you know, you can see what files are on the hard drive, and you can move them around, delete them, and create subdirectories. He was an early contributor to the Wine project. And that's an open source software application that allows Linux users to run Windows on Linux. So if you install a Wine emulator, that it sort of emulates, then makes Linux look like a Windows operating system, and then you can install Windows programs right on the Linux machine. Now it slows it down a little bit, but it was quite a successful project. He worked with David S. Miller on the Linux Spark port. You know, they were porting Linux to a Spark machine, and he wrote several video and network drivers for that port, as well as the library ports to the platform. Now, he also extended Linux to the MIPS processors, he took the Minix port for MIPS processors and extended it to work on the SGI Indies computer. So he was really into Linux big time and working on porting it to do and new and better and faster machines. In the summer of 1997, then with Ingo Molnar, this is before 97, he wrote the RAID 1 and RAID 5 drivers for Linux. This is a way to use an array of low-cost drives, and then you can basically stripe data across them, and it's a way. So if one drive goes out, you can just hot swap and put in another drive. It's a very robust storage technique. And he wrote the RAID 1 and RAID 5 drivers for Linux. In 1997, he was interviewed by Microsoft for a job on the Internet Explorer Unix team. So they said, wow, this guy looks pretty good. He's got good programming background. But he couldn't get an H-1B visa because he didn't have a degree.
Ah, how about that?
So Microsoft couldn't hire him. So de Acasa started the Genome Project with Frederico Mina in August of 1997 after he was, turned down by Microsoft. And, of course, the Genome Project is a completely free desktop environment for Linux. And he wrote it for Linux as well as for other Linux-like operating systems. You see, Linux is sort of the core system is text-based, and people are used to Windows. So this was like a Windows interface for a Linux machine. So Linux is used for very big time on servers. They probably have the servers on the internet probably Linux. Probably 70 or 80% of the Linux servers on the internet are Linux based. But they really never penetrated the client side because there wasn't a good interface. So he wanted to work on the Genome Project. In 1999, de Acasa co-founded Helix Code, which was a genome-oriented company. So he was trying to make a little money here by providing genome support on this thing with Helix Code. In 2001, a couple of years later, they renamed Helix Code Zimian. I had to check on how to pronounce this one. Z-I-M-I-A-N.
Yeah.
And it's
I think you got it.
The Zimian is they started working at Zimian on the Mono project, and this was to implement Microsoft's new .NET development platform for Linux and Unix-like operating systems. So, because .NET was a very nice environment for developing web applications. So he came up with the Mono project. By the way, there are a lot of patent infringement lawsuits between Zimian and Microsoft. They didn't actually like him implementing .NET in Linux, because Linux, you know, the big competitor. In August of 2003, Zimian was purchased by Novell, and DiCaza was named vice president of developer platform, vice president of development platforms, or platform developer. And so it was, so he finally called me, says, "Mom, you know, I never graduated, but now I'm vice president at Novell." So he was, and of course, Novell was trying to make a big push into the open source arena. They didn't really successfully do that too well, but this was what they were attempting to do back in the 2003 timeframe. In May 2011, DiCaza started to replace Mono Touch and Mono for the Android. And he started to, you know, basically develop Mono and .NET for Android applications after Novell was bought by Attachmate, and all the projects were abandoned. In other words, he was working on these things at Novell. Novell abandoned what he was working on, so then he pulled all the projects that he was working on into a new company called Xamarin, which was a new company that he'd created. After they pulled out, DiCaza endorsed Microsoft OpenXML document standard, and he got a lot of criticism from his open source buddies over that. But he said, "Look, it works, and I'm just going to be a practical guy. If it works, let's use it." He's also been a longtime advocate of using Mono, a free software implementation of Microsoft's .NET framework that runs within the GNOME desktop environment. In August 2012, DiCaza was criticized the Linux desktop as being killed by Apple. You know, I was interesting. I started reading all of his blogs, and so he was blogging about it. And what actually happened? The after he left GNOME, it started. You know, open source software takes a life of its own. And many people, including Linus Torvalds, did not really agree with the way that GNOME had been progressing. They were trying to make it too user-friendly. And so for hardcore programmers, it was harder to do the configurations that they wanted. They didn't like the particular direction that it was taken. And there were also, when Apple came out with OS X, remember, OS X is really a very nice user interface built on top of a Unix-like operating system. So all of a sudden, Apple X, because it was Unix-like at the core, started attracting developers. So developers that would have worked on GNOME and on Linux started defecting, going to the Apple desktop. So that's why he was saying that the Linux desktop was killed by Apple when they went to OS X. Now, DiCaza specifically criticized sort of developer-focused culture and the lack of backward compatibility and the fragmentation among the various Linux distributions. I started reading all of his blogs. So what happened is these developers, they get so hung up on what they want to do, and they'll make changes that aren't not backward compatible, and the poor users left out there hanging to dry. And so this sort of fragmentation and developer centric culture, he felt, was the reason that Linux would never become a dominant client operating system. It already had the server market, but not on the client side. On March 2003, DiCaza announced on his personal blog that he regularly used the Mac operating system instead of Linux for desktop computing. So this was like, so I read his blogs. It was like a huge transition. When he was actually at Novell developing the desktop, he used Linux all the time because he always liked to call it the dog food argument. You said you eat your own dog food, and then if you eat your own dog food, you know how to make it better. So when he was a Linux developer, he ate his own dog food and he just used Linux. But Once he left Novell and started thinking more broadly, he went on a vacation. He talked about this on another one. He went on vacation and he took his Mac with him and he took a Linux box with him, but he never opened up the Linux box. He just used the Mac. And then he noticed that over time, he was using the Mac more and more and Linux less and less because he didn't have to tinker with it. He'd turn on the Mac and it'd always work. He wouldn't have to get a new driver, wouldn't have to rebuild the kernel. It was always working. It was just so reliable. He just started using it more and more, and he discovered, hey, I'm pretty much using OS X all the time. And so even he defected to OS X. Miguel Diacaza received the Software Foundation Award in 1999 for advancement of free software. He received the MIT Tech Review 1999 Innovator of the Year Award, and he was one of Time Magazine's 100 Innovators of the New Century. He was named that in 2000. His blog, which is very interesting to read, I like reading this, and I read Linus Torvalds' blog, who's of course the creator of Linux, and his blog is tirania.org/blog, tirania.org/blog. He's quite a good writer. And you begin to understand when you look at his whole evolution, sort of the politics of open source software. So here's a guy that I don't know if he really ever made any money, but at least he did make it to the VP level without his bachelor's degree. So there you go. All you ever wanted to know about Miguel de Icaza.
Now, I took a little bit of Spanish in high school and college, but the word autonoma, I am not familiar with. So I looked it up. You know what it means?
No.
Autonomous. This is the Autonomous National University of Mexico.
Okay, there we go.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, very good.
I'm sure. Okay.
And he didn't, but he didn't make it out.
No, he didn't make it out. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by. Your chance to win a fabulous prize comes up when we play the pop quiz here on Tech Talk Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk.
I have AP
Radio.
Up and I can see
IT
you.
Trends,
what do you want the answer to be?
Internet and IT careers.
I don't know.
More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up.
I think
home.
The
technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
I hope you've been paying attention because we start out saying this is a radio show, but
right.
As you all know, it's a classroom of the airways.
Of course.
And when there's a classroom of the airways, we are going to have an assessment. We're going to have a pop quiz, which is going to determine whether you have been listening. If you get the correct answer to the pop quiz, you'll win two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karem Dining Room. That's either at Falls Church or at Woodbridge. And shortly thereafter, we'll probably have other dining rooms opening up. Earlier in the show, I was talking about Miguel de Icaza. Of course, he's an open source software programmer, best known for a particular program that he wrote for Linux. What is the name of that program that he wrote for Linux?
If you have the answer, you need to call us right now with that answer in order to win your prize. You didn't tell them what they win. If
I did.
You did?
Yeah, two tickets.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I did.
All right.
Yes, indeed.
I was looking at something in the profile here, so I could tell you that if you're calling from west of El Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, the number is 877-936-9333. If you're calling from east of Falls Church, Virginia, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. Or
if you're calling from Kathmandu, Nepal, or any other place which is difficult to reach, where it's difficult to get phone connection, you can use Skype. Simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and your call will be forwarded directly to the studio.
And, of course, the number is 877-936-9333. The answer is also the name of something you might find in somebody's front yard, just to give you a little bit of, this is a little bit of a hard question.
Okay, that's it. A texting juror was tossed in jail. You know, do you have a problem, like, you know, you always want to check your cell phone to see if there's any kind of
it's
texting
addictive,
going on.
Of course, yes.
I have that problem. I tinker with my cell phone a lot. Well, Benjamin Kohler, 26, was a jury member at a trial in Oregon, and he was sitting through testimony, which, you know, he felt was a little bit boring.
Mm-hmm.
You might imagine the testimony really wasn't that interest. The defendant was accused of armed robbery. Now, they wanted to show a surveillance video, so they turned down the lights in the studio. They dimmed the lights. And, of course, Benjamin had been holding his cell phone down very low and kind of like texting. So, because there's this panel in front of the jury, so they thought,
sure.
So he's holding it down low. They couldn't see what he was doing. But they dimmed the lights, and it turned out that his iPhone or his smartphone then was, the screen was lit up, and his face was lit up in the glow of the iPhone.
Oh, good.
So the judge was sitting there looking at the jury in this dimmed room, and the judge had specifically told the jury not to use their cell phones. And the judge was Dennis Graves. Graves took a very dark view of Kohler's glowing face.
Uh-huh.
And he tossed him in jail for 2 days, citing contempt of court. Now, Ben's friends are laughing because they said it's so Ben-ish.
So Ben-ish.
He just can't keep his hands off his cell phone.
Now, we don't have a winner yet, so, Doc, why don't you ask the question one more time?
Okay, earlier in the show, we were talking about Miguel de Acasa. What was the name of the program that he developed for the Linux platform that he's so well known for?
Now, I said it sounds like something you'd find in somebody's front yard. It's spelled the same way. It doesn't sound the same way. It's spelled the same way as something you might find in somebody's garden, like one of those clay guys or something.
So the police arrested a suspect for the distributed denial of service attack against Spam House. He was a 35-year-old man. He's a Dutch national, but he was arrested at his home in Barcelona, Spain, under a British arrest warrant. His computer and his mobile phone have been seized, and he'll be extradited to the Netherlands on charges of aiding an unprecedentedly serious attack on the nonprofit organization Spam House.
Mm-hmm.
Now, see, Spam House keeps a list of all of the servers that send out spam, and they create a blacklist. And if you're on the Spam House blacklist, then the spam filters know to simply ignore anything that's coming from that server and put it directly into the spam folder. And so, people that are spammers really don't like Spam House. You can go to spamhouse.org if you want to see what the web. It's a great service that they have. Now, although the identity of the man hasn't been released, it's suggested that he's Sven Kampfus, the owner and manager of the Dutch hosting firm Cyber Bunker, which has been feuding with Spam House over the years, and it's claimed that he is responsible for the distributed denial of service attack. Cyber Bunker is a Dutch company based in a former nuclear bunker that provides anonymous hosting of anything, anonymous hosting like for spammers. But they say they will not host child pornography or any kind of terrorist stuff. Now, the firm denies being responsible for the spam, but Spam House has listed Cyber Bunker on its blacklist, and Sven has been very upset with them.
Sven.
Now, last month, the attacks on Spam House servers saw 300 gigabytes per second of traffic heading from 30,000 unique DNS resolvers. They were using this this DNS amplification system that I talked about last week to really get this flood of data. And so much data was flooded to the Spam House servers from a distributed system of bots of 30,000 that they basically shut it down. And so they denied service to the people that were using them from this distributed attack. So it's called the distributed denial of service attack, and it was extremely, extremely effective.
Okay. We have people on the phone now. Let's go to line three, because this guy has the right answer. This is Mark calling from Rockville, Maryland. Rock, good morning. Mark, good morning and welcome to the show. Doc, go ahead and ask the question again.
Yeah, earlier in the show we talked about Miguel de Icaza. What program is he known for that runs on top of the Linux platform? That is correct. Very good. Correct. You win two tickets to fine dining to the Escoffier Dining Room, Corem Dining Room. Just stay on the line and give your name, number, and email address to Andrew, and we'll get the tickets out to you next week.
Mark, thank you for listening. Thank you for calling. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, and 103.5 FM HD2. We'll have more of Tech Talk Radio right after this.
It's technology. It's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Living Social was hacked. The Daily Deal's website, Living Social, has been hacked, and it compromised the personal information of more than 50 million people. The hackers appear to have obtained the names, the email address, the birth dates, and the encrypted passwords of the vast majority of the Living Social customers. The Washington, D.C.-based site, owned in part by Amazon, claims around 70 million customers worldwide, but the divisions in the Philippines, South Korea, Indonesia, Thailand remained unaffected because they were hosted on different servers. In his email to his users and to his employees, Living Social CEO Tim O'Shaughnessy wrote, "We recently experienced a cyber attack on our computers that resulted in the unauthorized access to some customer data. We're now actively working with law enforcement to fix the problem." He advised customers to create new passwords. Living Social has subsequently reset customer passwords, although it's not clear if the customer passwords were reset or just those who were affected by the all were reset or just those affected by the hack. Now, the good news is that merchant data and customer financial data, in other words, credit card numbers, appear to be safe. They weren't stored in that same database cache. Given the type of data stolen, it's likely that the attacks were used a web app to get in using some sort of SQL injection techniques. Now, here's what you have to do. I know many of you tend to use the same password everywhere.
Yeah. You're looking at me.
Which is a big problem. And so chances are they got the hash of that of the passwords, and you can take a hash, which is an encrypted version of passwords, and there are a lot of different ways to actually de-encrypt that, and the very successful brute force ways to do it. So chances are they are going to be able, if they want, to get your password. And now they know your birth date, so they may be able to get a hold of your email account. So if you have a living social password, then it's the same everywhere else. I'd go to all your other sites, and I would change your password, and I would make a point not to have the same password everywhere. You also might want to log onto your email accounts to make certain that they haven't been hacked. Now, there are two things you want to check for. Sometimes what they'll do is they'll log into your email account with the password, and they'll add an extra forwarding address. So that way they can use your email account to reset passwords, and they're forwarded a copy of the email. So check for forwarding to make certain that there knows that there's no forwarding been set up on the machine. Now, you also might want to check for any account activity, like if you've got Gmail, you can go to the lower right-hand corner of your inbox, and there's something called a recent activity, and click on the link just below that says details, and it will show you the IP address where all the attempts to log on to your account have come from, so you can see whether somebody's tried to hack your account. So just a little bit of precaution, and as always, we advise better password management.
We're just going to keep it here, Doc, and we've got so little time left.
Okay, let's just do that. Okay, Netflix CEO says that the future of TV is in apps. This is kind of interesting. I mean, TV is really shifting. As the internet TV grows from millions to billions, Netflix, Home Box Office, HBO, ESPN are leading the way, and internet TV is very shortly going to replace broadcast TV, according to the man who would really want that to happen, Reed Hastings, CEO of Netflix. Netflix currently has 30 million U.S. subscribers, a bit more than HBO, and about 9 million more than the biggest cable company, Comcast. Hastings projected that Netflix's audience would grow to as many as 90 million as it expands globally. Netflix and Amazon are both trying to create original content. Netflix created The House of Cards, which was viewed as a big success. Amazon this month launched 14 original comedy and children's shows. This week, CBS said, you know, there could be a trend here that we better watch out. So they made an investment in an online TV provider, SyncBank, which can stream live shows on the internet. Others such as Fox and Univision are considering pulling off the airs, public airways, and making their content available only through a pay model. Now, a host of major broadcasters last week renewed a fight against Aereo, A-E-R-E-O, which streams local broadcasts over the internet for a small subscription fee. This is very interesting. It's Aereo.com, A-E-R-E-O. They are currently in New York City, and all of the over-the-air broadcasts they stream, and you can get it for $8 a month. They're coming to Washington soon. See, so it could be that you could get Netflix, which is you could get that for $8 a month. You could sign up for Aereo. That would give you all the over-the-air broadcasts, so you don't have to have this, you don't worry about an antenna or anything. And then you could just stop subscribing to these expensive bundles that you know, that Verizon offers or Comcast offers.
Yeah.
And so what we are moving toward is a case where just it's a la carte. You just get what you want and pay for instead of having to get some big bundle. Right now, streaming Netflix videos take one-third of all U.S. bandwidth.
Good grief.
Think about that. One-third of all U.S. bandwidth during the peak traffic hours, and its average subscriber streams 87 minutes of video a day. Well, listen, we, you know, time's up again, and the show just flew by. Tell you, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu. Also, go to techtalkonline.com or go to Apple iTunes to subscribe to the podcast. And always check out stratford.edu to check out the programs and let them know that you heard about them on Tech Talk.
Thank you for listening. If you missed the show, want to hear it again, it airs on this station at 6 o'clock tomorrow evening.
Paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio. Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Nats and Caps on the air today. The Nats continue the homestand against the Reds. The game starts at 1 o'clock, their pregame at 12:30. And the Caps against the Bruins tonight at the Verizon Center. And the puck drops here at 7 o'clock. Sunny, nice in the 70s today. Right now, 61 degrees outside our studios in Northwest at 10 a.m.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts